The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
I'm delighted that this week's inductee into our culture club here on The Last Word at Today FM is one of Ireland's most acclaimed novelists. You would all know Room, which of course was also turned into an acclaimed film adaptation starring Brie Larson. Emma Donoghue, thank you very much for being with us. But before I start asking you for all of your choices across movies, music, books, whatever, tell us a little bit about your new novel, Akin. What's it all about?
Well, Akin's my first contemporary one since Room, and it's set now but very much haunted by the past. So Noah is a 79-year-old New York professor, a chemistry professor, and he's heading back to his hometown of Nice to try and sort out what his mother was up to during the war. But at the last minute, his trip is not quite foiled, but made more difficult by a social worker twisting his arm and making him take on the temporary guardianship of a great nephew he's never met, a real hard case from Brooklyn, an 11-year-old called Michael. So this rather unlikely duo head off to the Riviera together. And I've never written a novel with such an age span between its characters, you know, from 79 till 11. They're different worlds, different expertises, different skills, different bad habits. And I really enjoyed writing this one.
Is this totally from your imagination, or do you find stories that you might pick up reading somewhere else in newspapers or on the internet that you then weave into your work?
It's a made-up story, but it was suggested a bit by the artist Matisse in Nice. And also, I met a guy once who I knew slightly, and I said, "How are you enjoying retirement?" And he said, "Oh, well, actually, my young teenage son fathered a child with an older woman who's not able to raise the child, so I find myself raising my grandson." And I thought, that wasn't his retirement plan, was it? So life takes you in surprising directions. So that's an example of the kind of little thing that you would just come across or hear, which all feeds into the story pot.
Did you immediately, when you heard that, think of that as the germ of an idea
for
a story?
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure I wrote it down as well. I keep everything.
Do you write notes all through your life?
I do. I keep notes on my phone for about 20 different projects, yes. And often there'd be a long gestation. I mean, really, this novel was triggered by my living in Nice. We were sent there for my partner's job back in 2011. We loved it so much we went back for another year in 2015. And really, this novel grows so vividly out of my Nice years in a way that I've never done a fiction that's so clearly inspired by one place before. And so I would say on my phone, every time I walked my kids to school or back, I was taking little notes on things I saw, taking photos, taking video, eating a lot of pastries, obviously, because it had to be done for the research.
Okay, well, when we're on books, we might as well ask you, who is your favourite author, if you had to name one, because I'd imagine you probably read an enormous amount.
I do. Let's see, if all the rest of us were to be wiped out in some catastrophic event, I think saving Roddy Doyle would be a useful kind of, collection of our best, all within one bald cranium. I was sitting behind him at an event and I was looking at his shiny head and I was just thinking, there's everything in there, from the chatty, contemporary, vernacular of The Commitments through to, his really gritty and political historical fiction like A Star Called Henry, his screenplays, the film Rosie recently, so
which
beautiful.
Was wonderful.
So he's just a genius and a really unpretentious, down-to-earth genius who's done such good things with his influence as well.
You mentioned A Star Called Henry there. Why in particular that? Have you picked that out?
That book blew me away because when I was growing up, I realise now I should have studied history at college, but I just thought of history as the endless Irish revolutions, one failed revolution after another. And A Star Called Henry is about the 1916 rising, but from a kind of strongly Labour perspective, like the sheer hideous poverty of the Dublin slums and the kind of, wrath of the downtrodden in social terms. And that really grabbed me as a whole fresh angle on it. And it's got fantastic women in there as well. And an amazing sex scene in the GPO during the rising. So he's just outstanding. He's just not like anybody else. He's unfettered by convention, whether he's writing contemporary or historical fiction.
You mentioned his ability to write about women. I mean, even you mentioned Rosie, which of course he did the screenplay for last
whenever
year.
Whenever someone says that stupid thing about, oh, I don't think men can write women, I always give The Woman Who Walked Into Doors
that's
as
just what
perfect
I was about to say
example.
To you.
Yeah, one of the more feminist books I've ever read. And he does children's books beautifully as well. I once wept convulsively in the gift shop of Bunratty Castle because I read one of his picture books about a girl with a dead mother. And I've still never been able to buy that book because it moves me so much. I'm afraid to have it in the house.
Okay. Your favourite movie, which you've picked, of course, is an adaptation of a series of books as well, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Why have you picked this?
You know, not only did I enjoy all those three films, but I watched all the behind-the-scenes videos as well while I was home with each of the babies. It's a fascinating example of sort of communal creativity that Peter Jackson seemed to create a space in which I remember that, like, there's one guy who's featured in those behind-the-scenes videos who all he did was the really, really realistic chainmail. There's a moment in it as well when they say they suddenly got a whole new idea for how to represent Gollum, and they more or less scrapped all their initial footage and went back. And the zeal for decoration of objects, even the undersides, you know, it's like with the Arda chalice, you know, that they would decorate only the bits that only God could see. It was like that with Lord of the Rings. They took these other worlds so seriously, and they poured their energies into bringing them to life on film. And I think that the obsessiveness of the project really pays off.
We have a clip from The Return of the King, and this is where Aragorn encourages his army before the Battle of Morannon.
Same fear that would take the heart of me. A day may come when the courage of men fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship. But it is not this day. An hour of wolves and shattered shields when the age of men comes crashing down. But it is not this day. This day we fight. By all that you hold dear, on this good earth, I bid you stand, men of the West!
The drama.
Superb, and the way the soundtrack and the phrases of the speech are sort of shaped together to that great climax. And actually it reminds me of older texts like, you know, Henry V, Laurence Olivier giving that speech before Agincourt, you know, beautifully done.
Of course, you're not the first person on Culture Club to have picked out The Lord of the Rings as favourite movie. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue did so recently as well here on
no,
the show.
No, there's a weird cousin connection then.
I think you spell your names differently, don't you? You spell Donoghue differently. Emma Donoghue is with us for Culture Club today if you're just joining us. And does that mean then when it comes to television, if you like Lord of the Rings, did you go for Game of Thrones?
You know, I watched the first season, but it was a tad too rapey for me. There was an awful lot of, and here's the latest naked and bound woman. So that wouldn't be my top choice.
I can understand that one. I am surprised by one of your favourite TV shows, Grey's Anatomy. Why so?
I've seen every single episode. There's just something about a hospital as a setting. You know, everything is so life and death you know, somehow all the silliness of their interconnected love lives is given gravitas by the fact that the woman in the next room is about to die unless they do some, you know, world, you know, innovating bit of surgery. I just can't resist. And they're all so beautiful. It does bother me. The women always have their hair hanging in their faces as they do the surgery, you know. But yes, I've seen everyone. And, you know, when I've written medical characters several times, and I think there's a distinct Grey's Anatomy influence there. You know, you'd be surprised how much TV influences fiction.
Well, actually, I'm going to take one clip from Grey's Anatomy. This is from series two, where Meredith asks Derek to choose her over his wife.
I lied. I'm not out of this relationship. I'm in. I'm so in, it's humiliating because here I am begging.
Meredith, just
shut
just...
up. You say Meredith and I yell, remember?
Yeah.
Okay. Here it is. Your choice, it's simple. Her or me. And I'm sure she's really great. But Derek, I love you. In a really, really big. Pretend to like your taste in music. Let you eat the last piece of cheesecake. Hold a radio over my head outside your window. Unfortunate way that makes me hate you. Love you. So pick me. Choose me. Love me. I'll be at Joe's tonight. So if you do decide to sign the papers, meet me there.
Emma Donoghue, you surprised me with that one.
I know, and I still haven't got over his death either. You know, it's brutal when you're really attached to a show and you've been watching it for more than a decade, and then, probably for contractual reasons, suddenly a beloved character is, you know, cut down in his prime.
Okay, well, another choice you have, I think Ardal O'Hanlon picked this one, Deadwood. Why did you like Deadwood so much?
Oh, that's the best written television I've seen. Because the writer was trying to bring to life the frontier town atmosphere, he made a really interesting decision that he would have them speak in almost Shakespearean colourful English. And instead of using the real curses of the time, which strike us as just silly, he would let them do serious cursing in our way. So it's an interesting language. It's probably not exactly what they did speak in 1870s Deadwood, but it's so flavourful and dramatic and vivid. So I found that series riveting. Calamity Jane was a particularly good character. The evil but magnetic owner of the bar as well. It was a brilliant show. And one of the actors from Deadwood even turned up as our villain in the film of Room. So that was a particular thrill for me.
Of course, largely written by David Milch. And one other TV show I wanted to get from you, one that I'm not familiar with, and I think this must go back probably to your childhood, The Duchess of Duke Street.
You know, it's funny. When I'm writing historical fiction now, I suspect it's that I was strongly influenced by a little handful of shows way back when, like The Oneiden Line, and one of them was The Duchess of Duke Street. And they were often very, you know, woman-centred stories of people kind of rising up out of their social place that they'd been born to. You know, those stories of kind of, you know, ambition in a previous era. Corsets, but also serious power brokering. So The Duchess of Duke Street was one that I watched with my mother in a way. I was just completely riveted by it. And I always used to dance to the theme tunes as well.
There's one other TV show, and actually this has also been recommended to us, and I still, for whatever reason, haven't been able to get my hands on it, and everybody tells me it's excellent, and you've picked Years and Years.
Yeah,
just describe what it's about and why you like it so much.
I subscribe to HBO just to watch this show. It's by Russell Davies, very interesting writer, known for things like Doctor Who, and it follows Britain in a dystopian way from now till 10 years on. And the real trick of the show is that it's not just clever concept stuff about what might happen, you know, the refugee crisis getting worse and the rise of, you know, a right-wing populist leader and sort of cyborg changes to human bodies, but it's a real warm kind of family as well. So you care about these siblings, even as society is falling apart all around them. And Emma Thompson just steals the show as this sinister politician who's kind of, you know, blunt and likable and gets lots of fans, even as she's proposing effectively concentration camps for refugees. So it's the most thought-provoking thing on television, Years and Years.
We have a clip in which Daniel Lyons, the character, reminisces about how politics used to be boring before 2008 and how much there is to be scared of nowadays.
I don't know if I could have a kid in a world like this.
Oh, that's happy, thanks.
Really, though, it's, it is like that Rook woman said. Things were okay a few years ago before 2008. Do you remember back then we used to think politics was boring?
Those were the days.
But now, I worry about everything. I don't know what to worry about first, never mind the government. It's the sodding banks. They terrify me. And it's not even them. It's the companies, the brands, the corporations. They treat us like algorithms while they go around poisoning the air and the temperature and the rain. And don't even start me on ISIS. Oh, now we've got America. Never thought I'd be scared of America in a million years, but we've got fake news and false facts. I don't even know what's true anymore. What sort of world are we in? Because if it's this bad now, what's it going to be like for you? 30 years' time, 10 years, 5 years. What's it going to be like?
Okay, I'm definitely going to have to get that.
And before his delivery's brilliant. He delivers that so kind of casually and naturally, you know.
And before we get to the break, Emma Donoghue, I'm going to move to podcast running on for it because you have picked most definitely a podcast that nobody has picked in previous editions of Culture
Club. It's a
bit
obscure, yes. I listened to this one as, listen to me using the old-fashioned verb, read. I listened to this one as preparation for writing Akin. It's called Chemistry in Its Element.
And what's
it
about?
It's wonderfully geeky. Each week they take one particular element of the periodic table and they tell you little anecdotes about it. And it's kind of, in a way, every element has a kind of a character. You know, some of them are villains and some of them are a great force for good and some have a hidden dark side. So basically, Noah, the protagonist of my novel, Akin, is a chemistry professor, and I wanted him to have this intimate, lifelong knowledge of the elements and be able to, you know, tell the kids stories about chemistry that would really bring it to life.
It's fascinating. We have, these are all about 7 minutes long, apparently, these little podcasts. Okay, this is the one, a clip from the episode in which they discuss the element aluminium.
nature has blessed us with vast quantities of aluminium. The most abundant metal in the Earth's crust, it's literally everywhere. Yet aluminium remained undiscovered until 1808, as it's bound up with oxygen and silicon into hundreds of different minerals, never appearing naturally in its metallic form. Sir Humphrey Davy, the Cornish chemist who discovered the metal, called it aluminum, after one of its source compounds, alum. Shortly after, however, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, or IUPAC, stepped in, standardizing the suffix to the more conventional ium. In a further twist to the nomenclature story, the American Chemical Society resurrected the original spelling in 1925, and so ironically it is the Americans, and not the British, that pronounce the element's name as Davy intended.
Okay, you sold me on that one, Emma. I'm actually going to find that because I haven't done any chemistry since
I
was in secondary school.
I love the pure geekishness of it. You know, yeah, the, a twist in the story. An extra syllable was added.
And I like it. So let's turn to stage. And you have made a choice, which was made only a couple of weeks ago, as it happens, by David McCullough of RTE for favourite play or musical. You too have gone for Hamilton. Why?
I know it doesn't seem very distinctive, but for anyone out there who hasn't seen Hamilton, it's better than all other musicals combined. It makes you realise that most musicals are incredibly old-fashioned and they only use the music of up to about 1960. Hamilton manages, it's not pure hip-hop, but it uses hip-hop among other forms, including jazz, including pop, to tell the story of one of the founding fathers. So it's the most, you know, refreshing combination of 18th century material and 21st century sensibility. And again, it's casting, it casts the founding fathers as a diverse array of people of colour as an extraordinary kind of meeting between their moment and ours. And so you see these amazing kind of unexpected echoes between now and then. You know, there's one line, for instance, that always gets a huge clap where Lafayette says to Hamilton, you know, they both came from outside the States, and he goes, "Immigrants, we get the job done." And so at a moment like that, you know, you're not seeing just a story of the 18th century or a comment on today. It's both those things at once, and it feels so new.
There's also an energy to it.
Oh, there is. The whole thing is danced and performed by the entire ensemble. And I've seen it now in two different casts in New York with Lin-Manuel Miranda himself as Hamilton, and then a much younger, taller Hamilton in London. And so, you know, it's not just about one person, even though it's called Hamilton. It's really about the entire revolutionary generation. And it's not so much that it's trying to be strictly realistic about how it was then, but it's almost a way of exploring what did the American experiment mean at its best. You know, the women have hugely important roles in it as well. And the songs are so intricately and brilliantly written. It's been estimated if they sang Hamilton at a normal speed, it would take 8 hours. So it's an incredibly condensed, erudite, brilliant, you know, it rhymes on words like manumission. It boils down this huge long biography into a really tight, pacey, thrilling 2.25 hours.
I think it was one of the few times I've been at something which I actually genuinely was jaw-dropping to watch the brilliance of it. Let's hear a little bit of Wait For It. Death doesn't discriminate. Is in the same, it takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep living anyway. We rise and we fall and we break and we make our mistakes. And if there's a reason, I'm still alive. When everyone who loves me has died, I'm willing to wait for it. Wait for it. I'm willing to wait for it.
Hamilton doesn't hesitate, he exhibits no restraint, takes and he takes and he takes and he keeps winning anyway, changes the game, plays and he raises the stakes, and if there's a reason he seems to thrive and so few survive, then goddammit, I'm willing to wait for it.
It's a terrific work of imagination as well, isn't
it? Did you hear that brilliant silence between the verse and the chorus? The whole thing goes absolutely noiseless for about 2.5 seconds. Oh, and you know, I went and bought the biography. It's based on, it's a good biography, but I still think, you know, nobody else but Lin-Manuel Miranda could have taken this biography full of detail and could have pared it down to such dramatic moments. I mean, taking the fact that, you know, Aaron Burr, who then famously shot Hamilton, that he was a more cautious and waiting kind of politician. You know, who would have thought to spin such a moving song out of it?
Apparently he took that book on holidays and then got the idea of when he was reading it as his holiday material. OK, let's move to your best gig. You have selected U2 at Croke Park in 1987 on the Joshua Tree tour. Why that particular gig?
Oh, I lost a shoe. I was lifted off my feet in the ecstasy of the crowd. It's the first gig I'd ever been to, a big concert where, you know, you were like standing up, not in seats. And I was lifted off my feet by the crowd. And I remember also some Egypt went up on the ridgepole and Bono talked him down. I was a teenager. It was the first time I'd been to a big event like this. I had no cynicism to come between me and Bono. I worshipped U2 so much. I wrote a line of their lyrics on every day of my homework notebook in school, and I would see it almost as, you know, telling me how that day was going to go, you know. So I used it like as a kind of a, you know, like a Bible, I have to admit. So I've never been more moved by music than that day, taking
how
part
you
in the
say
crowd.
You had no cynicism then about Bono. Do you have a certain degree now?
No, I don't mean specifically about him. I just mean I'd be a bit more cynical about everything now than I was as a teenager. So, I mean, when he like shouted out some inspiring message about everyone join Amnesty International, I was fully with him, you know. So it was just extraordinary, and it was well worth losing a shoe.
OK, I don't think we have the live version, but this is one of the songs from the Joshua Tree. This is With or Without You. That period, best musically, lyrically, vocally?
I think possibly so, because in the very early albums like Boy and October, they're a bit raw, and you can hear that Bono's shouting because he's never learned how to sing. You know, he said that himself, that he really had to retrain. And then later on, they got more, in a way, postmodernist and sort of playing with effects. But I would say the music in the 80s there was so heartfelt and sincere, and yet it was sonically very sophisticated. I think the Edge has always added an extraordinary kind of ability to create this huge soundscape. Like in that, you know, that's a well-made song you could do just with a guitar, but that slightly tingly track in the background that adds to its sort of unnerving power. And I love that moment when Bono suddenly jumps up to his high voice at a certain point. I'm envious of men having two voices in that way. You know, it's a whole other register.
OK, your favourite album and band is a really interesting choice. Tell us about it. I'm not familiar with this particular act.
Sure. Zrazy are an Irish duo, mostly known for their jazz work, but actually they have a whole sort of Celtic pop funk side to them too. And they're friends of mine too. And the reason I chose this album is not because they're friends of mine, but because when their album Give It All Up came out in 1994, It's the nearest I've ever come to being a groupie in that I went to several of their gigs and got to know them at the same time. And I just found their music like nothing I'd heard in Irish music. And they would, for instance, take something like the abortion information phone number that you were not allowed to publish at the time, and they turn it into a song. You know, they
in what way? Explain that.
They literally chant it. You know, there's a song called something like
6794700.
Yeah. You know, the sheer cheek and daring to take a forbidden phone number and make it into a song. You know, the traditional Irish elements and the poppy dancey elements, and the fact that they were such out lesbians. You know, that was an extraordinary moment when I began to look around and think, okay, Ireland at last is beginning to change, you know. So that particular album, Give It All Up, for me has just the smell of change to it, you know. And we've seen so many extraordinary changes in Ireland more recently, but for me it all began in that early 90s moment when people began to question everything.
We have a clip from that album by Zrazy, which is called When You Cry.
Once you were so strong, like a rock, unbreakable, unbendable, dependable. Then one day I heard a crack, your shell fell at my feet, you looked at me silently. And I said, I widen out the sky for you. And I dreamt that I could die for you. And I hold you like you want me to when you cry.
Track. Whatever happened to Zrazy? Are they
They're around. They're going strong. Yeah, and they've done such an interesting range of projects. You know, a lot of jazz in particular, and they still do a lot of live performing around Ireland.
Do you listen to a lot of contemporary music, or do you tend to go back to the stuff that you might have enjoyed in previous decades?
Not quite a lot of contemporary. I mean, because I have a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old, you know, I do a lot of listening to, you know, modern pop stuff.
By choice, yeah. Or just...
Well, you know, that's what they have playing when I'm in the car and I start to sing along, you know. They definitely keep me up to date. And then my son will play me selected, you know, rap tracks, but then he'll suddenly go, oh, too much cursing in this one.
And what do they make of your tastes?
I don't know that they respect them that much. So I've got my 50th coming up, but I've made myself an all 1970s playlist for that party. And actually, my kids really like some of them. Things like, you know, September by Earth, Wind and Fire.
Great
you know,
tune.
The kids nowadays are not that prejudiced against previous eras, because the playlisting or streaming mentality, in a way, it accepts all elements of music, no matter when they're from. So they're not too wedded to what's popular now.
And it allows them a degree of experimentation.
Yeah.
I wonder what they make of the first single you ever bought. We ask a lot of our inductees to the Culture Club to do this. We don't always get to it, but I am amused by your choice. Tell
you know,
us
it's a literary one again. It's Bright Eyes by Art Garfunkel, 1979, which was the theme tune from a TV adaptation of Watership Down. So I realise most of my choices, no matter what form it's in, have some connection to books. So I was a huge fan of the book Watership Down. And Art Garfunkel, although of course in general he was better off with Paul Simon, but this particular song has an eerie power, you know. It's the only song I know about rabbits, I suppose.
It was number one in 1979 for ages. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Bright eyes.
Garfunkel, Bright Eyes. We're coming to the end of this week's Culture Club with Emma Donoghue. Emma's new book is Akin, her new novel. Emma, it has been fantastic talking to you, and thank you for all those brilliant choices.
Me too. I've enjoyed the trip down memory lane.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.